remembering how to play it because I learned it recently. So.
Gosh,
I was about to say, I don't know this song.
How firm a foundation. This is a remote hint. Real quick, actually, just, I want to give you a little bit of something like heads up before we sing it. Is it the? This is an interesting hymn. The first verse is written from our perspective, singing to God, and the rest of the stanzas of the hymn are written from God's perspective, as in what He's saying to us. So,
a firm foundation of the saints of the Lord is laid from your faith in God's excellent word. What more can be said than to you, God hath said, to you who for refuge to Jesus have fled? Fear not, I am with thee, oh be not dismayed, for so, I am thy God.
All I wanted you to know is be aware of is as we're singing, after the first stanza, it's from God's perspective to us, not the other. This is how firm a foundation. And we're gonna try it. This is an old tune. You probably will recognize the tune because it's applied to lots of different hymns. So. Which is why I always forget it, because I think it's to a different hymn. Here we go.
How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in God's excellent word. What more can be said than to you God hath said, to you who for refuge to Jesus have fled?
That's the two. I see. Do that verse one more time.
How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in God's excellent word. What more can be said than to you God hath said, to you who for refuge to Jesus hath fled? Fear not, I am with thee, O be not dismayed, for I am thy God, and will still give thee aid. I'll strengthen thee, help thee, and there cause
thee to stand,
and cause thee to stand, upheld by my righteous omnipotent hand. Waters, I call thee to go. The rivers of sorrow shall not overflow, for I will be with thee in thine
troubles to bless.
For I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless, and sanctify to be thy deepest distress. Fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee, the only desire thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. The soul that our Jesus has named for I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake.
Oh, that was rough.
Three.
Alright. So let's make sure we know what we're saying. Like I said, the first verse is our perspective to God.
So this is the song that we're
singing.
I didn't realize that. I thought we were just singing a new song.
That's why it was so rough. How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in God's excellent word. Translation?
The foundation for the saints is in God's word.
There you go. The foundation of your faith is in God's word. Mm-hmm. Alright. So the first of the stanzas from God's perspective. Fear not, I'm with you. I will strengthen thee up, uphold thee with my victorious righteous right hand. Psalm 40, 41:10.
It's all in quotes, though.
Yeah, as in the idea of being God is saying this. The idea of being God is saying this. He's speaking this too.
I thought the idea was it's being quoted from somewhere.
No, no. Like speech quotes. When through the deep waters I call thee to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow, for I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress.
When I call you to go through deep waters, you won't be abundantly sad.
Reason?
Because I will be there.
And he's there to help you
out. That could come from
Romans 3:5-6.
It could. More directly, it comes from Isaiah 43. But, same sentiment in Romans. Yeah. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee, I only design thy dross to consume, and thy gold to refine.
He gives you what you can handle, because he's the one powering you.
First of all, what's dross mean?
I have no idea.
I know. I think, isn't it that garbage, whenever you refine the gold, it's all the impurities?
Yeah. Rubbish, trash, synonym for those things.
Swag.
Yes.
Thy dross, thy trash, rubbish, extraneous things that will burn up in the fire.
Impurities.
So he only designs our slag to consume?
Exactly. So the only thing that's going to burn up in the flame, as he says in Hebrews, the chaff will burn up in the fire, the gold is refined.
To make sure metaphor.
Right. And the soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes. Translation?
Jesus paid it all.
Yeah. I will not desert those who lean on Jesus.
I'm not going to desert those people who trust, lean on Christ. That soul.
Who get their peace.
Yes. Yeah. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. Ain't nothing going to bring them down.
Ain't nothing going to break my stride.
Ain't
nothing going to slow me down. Whoa. I got to keep on moving. Dude, that's the best song ever. I don't know why you don't like that song.
What's that
great?
If you'd like to read along with me. The authorship of this great hymn of the faith is one of the great hymnological mysteries. Believe it or not, this was a fairly famous hymn for a long time. When John Rippon, pastor of Carter Lane Baptist Church in London, published a selection of hymns from the best authors in 1787, the attribution for this hymn appeared only as K. Many suppose that Robert Keane, a close friend of Rippon's and the song leader at the Carter Lane Church from 1776 to 1793, is the mysterious author. However, no hymn in the early editions appeared to have been written by Keane. Appears to have been written by Keane, and other tunes bear his full name, so it is inconclusive that this hymn was his work as well. In this edition, there weren't any others by him, and in other editions that he wrote hymns for, his name's there. So why would, if he wrote this one, would his name not be there? Exactly. How Firm a Foundation was sung frequently in both the North and the South before the Civil War. It was a favorite hymn of Theodore Roosevelt, and that Andrew Jackson requested to be sung at his deathbed, and that Robert E. Lee asked to be sung at his funeral. The anonymous folk tune Foundation is an American contribution to the hymn that first appears with the text in Joseph Fun's 1832 genuine church music under the tune name Protection. Hymnology scholar Harry Askew has concluded that Protection was a new tune and not previously published. The composer remains unknown. So that tune, again, it's a tune, it's a folk tune, it's applied to lots of different songs.
Isn't the composer known, though?
By Kate.
Okay. The tune appears in other famous American 19th century collections such as the Sacred Harp, 1844, and the Southern Harmony, 1854, with some melodic variations and with changes in harmony. Earlier hymnals in the U.S. often use the tune Adeste Fidelis, associated indelibly with O Come All Ye Faithful. This hymn is often sung to the tune of O Come All Ye Faithful, so... How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in God's excellent word.
The hymn text was originally written with 7 4-line stanzas. 5 are included in the United Methodist hymnal with only 1 small alteration. The first stanza identifies this as a hymn of promises directly from Jesus. Stanzas 2-5 appear as direct quotations from Jesus, though many scriptural allusions come from the Old Testament. The unique power of this hymn is due to the fact that each of the 7 original stanzas were based on various biblical promises. Examples, Isaiah 41:10, fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you, yes, I will help you, I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. The other references you can see there. After it arrived in the U.S., one can be sure that it was a hymn that comforted many on both sides of the Civil War. This sermon in song continues to speak just as meaningfully today. No wonder it was first published under the title Exceedingly Great and Precious Promises. Question. Most of these are, like I said, come from quotations in Isaiah. If you're not, I'm with you. Be not dismayed, I am your God. I will give you aid, strengthen you, uphold you with my righteous right hand. I'll be with you, sanctify you in the deepest distress. My grace is all sufficient, shall be thy supply. Are these promises for the church age believer to claim?
Context, so I cannot tell you.
Good answer.
I believe that Hebrews.
Yeah, so good general rule of thumb. Comes from the epistles. Better bet that it's something that we can claim. Not always. There are still some things in the epistles that are not for us, really. Or for those first century believers. But general rule of thumb, you're on safe ground to say, comes from the epistles, promise that I can claim, sure. And another good rule of thumb, comes from the prophets, I really need to see the context to know if I can claim this promise as my own. My favorite whipping boy, Jeremiah 29:11, is a perfect example. Comes from the prophets, has nothing to do with church age believers. Fear not, I am your... I don't even remember what it is.
I seek to prosper.
I know the plans I have for you. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you.
I'm gonna read the examples.
I didn't get mad at you. I made sure that you understood that promise.
That's an important thing to me because I don't want the reason that that's always something that I bring up is not because I'm just out to ruin your good time or that's not the reason. The reason is I don't want you believing that God has said something to you that He hasn't. I think that is unhelpful to you as a Christian. If you go on, you're living your life believing that God has promised something to you that he hasn't, and then being let down when he's under no obligation to give you the thing that you thought he promised you. The issue is with your belief, not with God. And so I would hate for you to get somewhere down the line in your faith thinking that something was meant for you that really wasn't the whole time, and that causing a problem or causing you to stumble in your faith. I think that's just like easy thing to avoid. Just read it in context. There are a lot of bigger fish to fry with your faith that you'll stumble over as you continue down your walk. And this doesn't need to be one of them. Get this one out of the way. Just get used to reading things in context and figuring out what was he saying to that audience at that time. Does it apply to me? And working through the process logically. And then the bigger fish when they get there will be easier to fry. Put it that way.
Maybe that should be a mandatory class in all seminary degrees.
Learning how to read the Bible in context.
And
I assume that you get that out of the way.
I absolutely agree. It should be. And if you're going to the right seminaries, it is. But there are a lot of seminaries that aren't teaching things well.
Conservatively?
Yeah.
HBM? That's not a seminary. This is college.
I'm guessing you were thinking Fuller. Anyway, that's how firm a foundation. And so this hymn is one that's like, I appreciate the impact that it's had on history. I kind of like the tune, and I like the basic idea of let's look to the Word for the promises of God. It just skips a step in between.
And properly applied.
Yeah. Properly interpreted and applied.
I'll just come out and say I like it.
You didn't like it. That's alright.
I don't like singing it. Definitely not.
It's also better when the person who's leading the singing isn't stopping in the middle of every stanza because he keeps messing up.
I like the tune. I thought it was a good tune.
Yeah.
I'm thinking even lyrically. It's like it doesn't seem
to flow.
It doesn't seem to be as strong.
Okay, well,
strong.
How would you write Hebrews?
I don't know. I'm not a Hebrew. All right. I'm not sure.
Actually, you write a poem and then find music to put on.
I could do that. I've actually written some.
Are you going to play with us?
All right, this is the second to last time we get to do this. So,
this is the second to last time?
Yeah, because we still have Malachi after we finish Zechariah.
Second to last time to do Zechariah?
No. Second to last time to do this. Hosea, where does he go? North to south?
North.
North. About when?
Who?
Give me some names. Hosea.
Hosea?
What is Jeroboam 2?
Jeroboam 2, yeah, about there, a little bit earlier. Good. Hosea, Joel. North or south?
South,
yes. About when? According to my dating that I taught you. There's two very legitimate dates for Joel, so. What'd you say?
Ahaziah.
Around Ahaziah, a little bit after that, but not bad. Joash. Alright, Hosea, Joel, Amos. North. Where is he going? Ahaziah? No. Yeah, Jeroboam 2. There's actually that scene in Amos where he goes and talks to the priest of Jeroboam 2, right? And he says, I'm not a prophet, I'm the son of a prophet. I'm just a shepherd, but God told me to speak for him. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah.
It was earlier.
Much earlier. And who's he writing to?
Jehoram? Well, he's trying to write to Edom.
There you go, Edom. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah, during the reign of Jehoram, probably. Again, Joel and Obadiah are the two that are like wild cards. We don't know exactly where to date them. But that, I think, is the best dating. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah.
Jeroboam 2.
To the north at the end of Jeroboam 2's reign. Yes, nicely done. Samuel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah.
Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah.
Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah.
To Israel. The north. With the Assyrian invasion in the north.
To the south.
He used the north as a...
He used the destruction of the north to say, you see what happened to them? Do we really want to do the same thing?
No. And he had a fish
show. Yeah. Nahum. Who's he writing to?
What?
Nineveh. Nineveh. And when about? Destruction of Nineveh, which
663
means...
663 to 650 BC.
After Assyria has wiped out the north, so it's got to be somewhere in here.
Around Josiah?
Around Josiah, Josiah. More like Jehoiachin. But yeah, Josiah. Nahum Habakkuk. Habakkuk, my favorite prophet during the reign of Josiah, in the south. Zephaniah, also about the same time. And then...
Run out of handouts. It's all handouts now.
See if you had your
biblical attitude toward work. Where did that come from?
That was from College and Careers.
Yeah, I know. Christian worldview.
I was also College and Cruise.
These are the answers.
We get into the exile. We have naming the exilic prophets. Daniel.
Isaiah.
I know you weren't saying Daniel, but it's correct. Daniel.
I want to say Isaiah.
No, Isaiah's back here.
Okay.
Ahaz, Hezekiah. Uzziah, I should say. Jeremiah. Yeah, so Jeremiah is... at the time, like, before and after. He starts before, and he goes through and after. Who else? Jeremiah, Daniel. Who's the last major prophet other than Isaiah?
Right?
Who?
Nehemiah, is that it? Or is he just after?
Nehemiah is one of the guys who leads the return. He's not a prophet. Who's the last exilic prophet? And Daniel, Jeremiah. Isaiah's over here, so he's not it. Who's the last major prophet? Ezekiel, there you go. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations is part of Jeremiah. Ezekiel, Daniel, those are the four major prophets. Major purely because of length. Which, I think it's weird that Zechariah isn't considered a major prophet because he's longer than Daniel. But, that's just how it goes.
This is so confusing to be a major prophet.
Yeah, we just accept the tradition, then we move on. Even more. So we had Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Esther goes on during this time, and then who takes over Babylon? What king?
Persians,
yes. Persians under King Cyrus. And Cyrus comes on the scene and he says, y'all Israelites can go back to your homeland. And so they go back with Zerubbabel. And then in between Zerubbabel and Ezra's return, which two prophets show up and encourage them to rebuild the temple?
Hosea
is back here.
Nehemiah.
Haggai.
Nehemiah is not a prophet. Nehemiah is the guy who comes back last. And he's
Haggai.
He's the cupbearer. Haggai is one of them, yes. And who we're studying now.
Zechariah.
So that's up through where we are. Next week when we go over this our last time, we'll dig in and make sure we have our distinctives for each prophet to remember. Don't glaze over yet. We're just getting through the review.
Do you still have the
Haggai? I very likely do, but I have to search through all of my... So we are going to pick up where we left off in Zechariah, which is at the end of the four explanatory messages. Real quick, let's show you the, remember the outline. The outline of Zechariah is really easy. Got the 8 symbolic visions that took us 2 weeks to cover. And you have the 4 explanatory messages, which took us 1 week to cover. And now we're doing the 2 oracles, which should only take us 1 week. They're pretty straightforward. Much easier to interpret than the visions. If you will turn to Zechariah chapter 9 in your Bibles, we will start digging in. I forgot to pray again. Who keeps forgetting to remind me to stop and pray?
I mean, it was just the review, so I figured what's the harm in reviewing.
That's true. Someone want to pray for us?
Amen.
All right, Zechariah chapter 9. This is where, remember those liberal scholars who say that multiple people wrote Zechariah? Most of them will say starting at chapter 9 is where somebody else started writing. And they'll say there's a change in style that's so evident, so it had to have been somebody else. To which I say, so one person can't write both poetry and prose?
No.
Have you heard of Edgar Allan Poe or Charles Dickens or C.S. Lewis or... thousands of authors.
But these guys are dumb guys. They can't write guys.
Which is another total sidetrack, but something that I'm realizing in the modern church and just modern culture is the unquestioned assumption that just because we are later in history, we know more.
Everyone back then were apes.
Everyone back then was just a stupid idiot, couldn't possibly have something intelligent to say. We obviously know better than them. It's just all over. I see it more and more.
That's just
foolishness. The idea that the Founding Fathers wrote the Second Amendment with a particular purpose in mind and had a philosophy guiding their construction of the Constitution. They were just idiot, racist, bigoted white men who knew nothing. Don't you know? We're clearly smarter than they are. Sorry. Like I said, total sidetrack. That's why it's been on my mind lately, so you mentioned that.
That's just arrogance.
I know. So two oracles. First one is chapters 9 through 11. Second one is chapters 12 through 14. And they're both introduced with, if you read the ESV, the oracle of... da, 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 da. Some translations might say the burden. Or
the
burden.
Burden
the message, the weight is given to the Lord against so-and-so. And that sort of introduces the section. First oracle. Let's jump right in. Somebody want to read verses 1 through 8.
An oracle of the word of the Lord concerning the land of Hadrach, with its focus on Damascus. The eyes of all humanity, especially of the tribes of Israel, are toward the Lord, as are those of Hamath also, which adjoins Damascus and Tyre. And Sidon, I don't know how to say all those.
You got it.
Though they consider themselves to be very wise, Tyre built herself a fortification and piled up silver like dust and gold like the mud of the streets. Nevertheless, the Lord will evict her and shove her fortifications into the sea. She will be consumed by the fire. Ashkelon will see and be afraid. Gaza will be in great anguish, as will Ekron, for her hope will have been dried up. Gaza will lose her king, and Ashkelon will no longer be inhabited. Was to 8?
Yeah, actually, stop it at the end of 6.
At the end of 6. A mongrel people will live along Ashdod, will live in Ashdod, for I will greatly humiliate the Philistines.
So, he's listing off all of these geographical places that we don't have firm in our heads. So, I want to bring up a map to always know what we're talking about. I really don't like the way that Google Images has changed its normal way of displaying images. You have to take an extra step. So he starts out in Damascus. Hamath is around the same area, right around here. And then he moves on to the area of Philistia, where the Philistines come from. Ashkelon, Gaza, the famous cities in that area. Who else does he mention?
Tyre and Sidon.
Tyre and Sidon, which are up here. So essentially, all around Israel, right? On all sides. Everything surrounding Israel. What's going to happen to them? What's the general gist of what he's saying is going to come about?
They will be destroyed.
They're going to be destroyed, yeah.
So, judgment is coming.
Judgment is coming. Repent. Now we get verses 7 and 8. Switches a little bit. So somebody read 7 and 8 for me.
And I will remove their blood from their hands and their detestable things from between their teeth. Then they also will be our meant for our God and be like a clan in Judah, in Ekron like a Jebusite. But I will clamp around my house because of him who passes by and returns, and no oppressor will pass over him anymore. For now I have seen with my eyes.
Okay, there's a phrase in there that really makes me, or surprises me. He's talking about what's going to happen to them. He's continuing with the judgment, the first half of verse 7. And then, halfway through verse 7, he says, it too shall be a remnant for God. It shall be like a clan of Judah. Okay. That's interesting. First of all, the remnant. Whenever we see the remnant in the prophets, what are we talking about? First, let's just define remnant. I don't think we've talked about this very much. What is a remnant, if you're defining that word?
Something left over from something else.
Leftover. The remnant of Israel, or the remnant for God, almost always refers to the people of Israel who make it through the judgment and continue on. As in, remember, this is one unified book telling one story, and we're looking for who?
Jesus.
The seed. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Seed of the woman. We're looking for that guy who's going to fix everything. We're looking for the Messiah, Jesus. We know who he is. And so whenever we see the remnant going through the prophets, we're preserving that promise that this seed is coming. Like he's going to make it here. He's going to come from the remnant. And here he says, I'm going to make them, meaning all of these Gentile nations, a remnant for God, like the clan of Judah. Now, think with me just a moment. What happened during the church age? What happened when the gospel started going out to who?
Gentiles.
What did they become?
They were grafted in.
Grafted in to the cultivated olive tree of Israel. They became a remnant for our God, like the clan of Judah.
Yes.
Like this little like gospel nugget right here in the middle of all this judgment, which you see all throughout the prophets if you're looking for it. You see it all throughout the Old Testament. The plan all along was the surrounding nations, the Gentiles, were going to be saved by faith through grace also. By grace through faith also. It just becomes much clearer once the apostles show up. So I was struck by that when I was reading this. And then verse 8, what does he say? Somebody who has ESV, read that. I think they do a good job. Yeah.
Then I will camp at my house as a guard, so that none shall march to and fro. No oppressor shall again march over them, for now I see with my own eyes.
So what's God going to do once this remnant becomes like a clan of Judah?
Protect.
Yeah.
Guard.
He's going to set up shop at his house, his temple, like a guard. And he's going to protect him. He's going to guard him. So whether we're talking about end times, God literally setting up shop, Jesus sitting on the throne of David in the millennial kingdom.
It's like the longevity of the religion of the. So it's like Rome persecuting is the oppressors, and he doesn't let that quell
the existence of
yes
the nation. Interesting thought. Anyway, so that's kind of the introduction. Then he moves on to the coming king. And here we get, most appropriately, some very messianic promises. I believe it's in this chapter. I might be getting ahead of myself. So let me read 9 through 17.
Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. Look, your king is coming to you. He is legitimate and victorious, humble and riding on a donkey, on a young donkey, the foal of a female donkey. I will remove the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be removed. Then he will announce peace to the nations. His dominion will be from sea to sea, and from the Euphrates River to the ends of the earth. Moreover, as for you, because of our covenant relationship secured with blood, I will release your prisoners from the waterless pit. Return to the stronghold, you prisoners, with hope today. I declare that I will return double what was taken from you. I will bend Judah as my bow. I will load the bow with Ephraim, my arrow. I will stir up your sons, Zion, against yours, Greece, and I will make you Zion like a warrior sword.
Pause right there. There's a lot of images going on here, so let's break this up. First of all, remember a couple of things. What's Ephraim? What's that another name for?
Edom? I don't.
Who is Ephraim? Do we remember who he is in the story?
Isn't he one of Jacob's sons?
One of Joseph's sons.
Joseph, that's right, the other Jacob.
There you go. So yeah, remember, Jacob had 12 sons, one of his sons was Joseph. Joseph had 2 sons, Ephraim was one of them. And Manasseh. So Ephraim and Manasseh took the place of Levi in the 12, right? When they split up the land, you had the 12 tribes coming in. The tribe of Levi didn't get its own land. And the tribe of Joseph split into 2 and sort of became 2 tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim then sort of became the dominant tribe in Israel. And so Ephraim, whenever it says, oh, Ephraim, it's a synonym or a metonymy for Israel, the northern nation. So, like in verse 10, he says, I will cut off the chariots of Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem. Ephraim is a synonym for Israel. Jerusalem is a synonym for Judah, north and south countries coming together. And when he stretches Judah like a bow and puts Ephraim its arrow, we're using both halves of the nation that got divided into north and south. So that's those pictures there. Let's read again real quick. First of all, just give me the basic gist. What is God telling the people of Israel to do?
Have hope.
Have hope.
Rejoice.
Rejoice. Celebrate. Shout aloud. Why? Your king is coming to you. What does he have? Righteousness and salvation, and he's coming on a
donkey.
On the colt, the foal of a donkey. Ring a bell.
Go into the town. You'll find a donkey.
And you say to him, my master has need of it. And he'll give it to you. Exactly. What is today? Palm Sunday, the day that Christ rode into Jerusalem on a colt, the foal of a donkey. When the first half of this prophecy was fulfilled. Now, here's the question. Was the rest of it fulfilled?
No, they had not been made of gold.
Yeah, right, so substantiate your position. So, he says, I will cut off the chariot of Ephraim, the war horse from Jerusalem, the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. So this king, when he rides in on a foal of a donkey, he's going to cut off Israel's rule and reign for a time.
That's happened, yeah.
Paul's talking about that in Romans 11, right? I tell you that partial hardening has come over Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has been grafted in. But, lest you become too proud, all of Israel will be saved. That's Romans 11. He's talking about the same thing. the part that I think hasn't happened yet. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to your strongholds, O prisoners of hope. Today, I declare to you, I will restore to you double. I've bent Judah as my bow, Ephraim as its arrow. I'll string it up, sons of Zion, against Greece, and wield you like a warrior's sword. This triumphant conquering of Israel after the being cut off, I don't think has happened yet. I think that's going to be Millennial Kingdom. So here's another, this is a good example to talk about a concept that I haven't found a good example yet in the prophets because we've been going through them so fast. So I'm going to take a second to do this. I'm just going to use this. Actually, I can use this. This is a concept of, lots of people will call it telescoping prophecies. It's a concept that they used to teach in seminaries. I hear old seminarians talk about this a lot, and not a lot of young seminarians. I think it's a really good illustration. A couple of you have been hiking on mountains, right?
Yes. Yes.
Unfortunately, you said.
I got stuck on a mountain last year.
When you're hiking up a mountain, that's a double peak, like this, and you're right here. Thank you. And you're coming up to the peak. What do you see in your line of sight?
The peak.
You see the peak. Which one do you see?
This one.
This one, right?
Is the other peak higher than the first peak?
The other peak's higher than the first peak. So if it's high enough, you see it too. But what does it look like?
It just looks like one continuous.
It looks like one continuous. It looks like it's all the same mountain. Right? You don't see the valley in between them. As you're hiking up. This was very true when I hiked Guadalupe Peak, tallest peak in Texas. Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, there's like six times where you crest, and you're like, we're there. Oh, we're not there. Yeah. And you go through this whole thing, you're like, we're there. Oh, we're not there. And you keep going, and you just look. It looks like this, right? This is the illustration used to explain how lots of the messianic prophecies were given. And you see this particularly in Isaiah a whole lot. This is a good example of it, though. The first coming of Christ is this first section, or riding in on the colt of a donkey, breaking off Israel, the bow of Ephraim. That's this one. Now we keep reading the text. There's no break in the text. It just continues talking. And it says, as for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I'll set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. You'll return to your strongholds. Ephraim and Zion will be victorious over Greece. That's this one. And in between, there's been at least 2,000 years of history, right? But from the prophet's perspective, from the original reader's perspective, we just see the one. Right? We're just looking at it like this, and we see, oh yeah, the Messiah comes, and we get all this great stuff for Ephraim and Israel. I think this is a good illustration of how a lot of these prophecies and how the two comings of Christ end up playing out. And there's a lot of times where you see the New Testament authors quote half of a prophecy or be like, why did you stop right there? Well, because God intended for that first half of the prophecy to be fulfilled at this point in time, the first coming, and the second half of that prophecy to be fulfilled thousands of years later. It wasn't necessarily clearly indicated in the original text, but the play of history has revealed that to be the case. I think that's a good illustration. I wish it was more popular today than it is. Telescoping prophecy or the two mountains illustration. Okay, that. So that's why Zechariah 9, verses 9 through 13, I think is a perfect example of telescoping prophecy. Also, quick question. What is this waterless pit? And who's there?
Prisoners.
Prisoners. Who? Which prisoners?
So, what's the point of saying waterless pit? Why can't you just say waterless pit?
So, because the literal words are a cistern without water. So, you know what a cistern is?
Something that holds water.
Yeah, it's a well that doesn't have a natural source or spring. So it's like a big bucket. Made out of rock sunk into the ground that people would use to store their water in a big basin. So the point is, you're going to be stored in this pit and a cistern, and it doesn't have any water, and it doesn't have anything to quench your the pain that that's being caused to you.
Are we the water?
Is it Ephraim's prisoners?
So who's the you? Who's the nearest referent that by which you can identify the you?
Ephraim.
I will cut off the chariots from Ephraim, third person, and the war horse from Jerusalem. The battle bow shall be cut off. He, the king, shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, that gives you a clue. Because of the blood of my covenant with you, with whom does God have a covenant at this point in time? People of Israel, yeah. And I think the you would be verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughters of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughters of Jerusalem. That plural you. Zion and Jerusalem. Israel. I will set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to your strongholds, O prisoners of hope. Today I declare that I will restore to you double. So what do you think the waterless pit is?
The earth. Hell.
Any other thoughts?
It can be purgatory.
The earth, hell, or purgatory. Yeah, another possible thing that pops into my mind is the diaspora, the scattering of the 12 tribes, the earth, similar idea. I don't know. So that's why I asked. If you guys have a compelling answer to that, let me know.
I'm confident it's not purgatory.
It's not purgatory?
Yeah, don't worry about that one.
Okay. Verse 14. And then the Lord will appear over them, and his arrow will go forth like lightning. The Lord God will sound the trumpet and will march forth in a whirlwind of the south. And the Lord of hosts will protect them, and they shall devour and tread down the sling stones, and they shall drink and roar as if drunk with wine and be full like a bowl drenched like the corners of the altar. How is the corners of the altar drenched? What's it drenched in?
Blood.
They're going to have war, and they're going to be victorious in that war. On that day, the Lord their God will save them as the flock of his people, for like the jewels of a crown they shall shine on his land. For how great is his goodness, and how great is his beauty. Grain shall make the young men flourish, and new wine the young women, or the virgins. What's happening there?
It's the double all the things you lost.
Double all the things you lost. Yeah, he's explaining, first of all, how Judah and Ephraim are going to be his bow and arrow. And then he's going to take Israel and have war and win. And the double of all things he lost. It's going to be great. They're going to be living in the land. I think this is clearly directly millennial kingdom, yeah. Read Revelation 19. The rider on the white horse with his cloak drenched in blood, almost, you might say, like the corners of the altar, coming and wrecking shop and setting up his kingdom on earth. The oracle continues. Let's go verses 10, chapter 10, verses 1 through... Just go through 5 for now.
Ask the Lord for rain in the seasons of the late spring rains. The Lord who causes thunderstorms, and he will give everyone showers of rain and green growth in the fields. For the household gods have spoken wickedness. The soothsayers have seen a lie. And as for the dreamers, they have disclosed emptiness and give comfort in vain. Therefore the people set out like sheep and become scattered because they have no shepherd. I am enraged at the shepherds and will punish the lead goats. For the Lord who rules over all has brought blessing to his flock, the house of Judah, and will transform them into his majestic war horse. From him will come the cornerstone, the wall peg, the battle bow, and every ruler. And they will be like warriors trampling the mud of the streets in battle. They will fight for the Lord will... What? They will fight, for the Lord will be with them, and will defeat enemy cavalry.
There you go. We're still talking about what?
The bow.
Yeah.
The sword.
The battle that's going to restore Israel and Judah. Now he's kind of readdressing the Greece, the nations that they're going to conquer. Ask for rain. Or excuse me, I'm getting ahead of myself. Ask for rain, the Lord, in the season of the spring rain, and the Lord who makes the storm clouds, he will give them showers of rain to everyone, the vegetation in the field. So, in this conquering, ask and it will be given, seek and you shall find, kind of promises are being made here. Why? Why is all this going to happen? Verses 3 through 5.
Because the shepherds have enraged him?
Yeah. They're like sheep without a shepherd, and the people who have been taken lead are not doing the greatest. And so the Lord of hosts is going to be the true shepherd. He's going to show up, and he's going to, from Judah shall come the cornerstone, the tent peg, the battle bow, the ruler. Who are we talking about?
The rider on the white horse.
There you go. A.K.A.?
Squirrel.
Jesus. Squirrel. Trampling the foe in the mud of the streets, they shall fight because the Lord is with them. They shall put to shame riders on horses. They are going to win. I'll strengthen the house of Judah. I'll save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back because I have compassion on them. They shall be as though I have not rejected them. Pause right there. Strengthen the house of Judah. Save the house of
Joseph,
a.k.a. Ephraim, a.k.a. Israel, northern nations, right? And we have the two divided kingdoms. As in, I'm going to bring them all back together. Why?
To make them more cohesive? To be a weapon?
Well, what's the motivation for him doing this? What does he say?
For national and
because he wants to! Because God gets to do what he wants to do! Because I have compassion on them. Who are you to say that I don't get to have compassion on who I want to have compassion? Exodus 32, right? I am the Lord your God. I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. Show mercy on whom I will show mercy. And it shall be as though I had not rejected them. At this point in time, where is the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, Ephraim, Joseph?
In exile?
Where physically or where, like, spiritually?
Both. Let's look at our timeline. We're talking right here, right?
Yeah. Well,
so when's the last time we saw the Northern Kingdom?
It was kind of in shambles and broken.
Yeah. 722 BC, what happened?
Yeah,
by?
Assyrians.
What happened to all the people that live in there?
They got assimilated.
Yeah, they got assimilated. They got scattered.
Turned into Samaria.
Still turned into Samaria, a lot of them, yeah. Right? Samaritans, that's where they come from. The half-breeds. Still, to this day, have never regrouped. And here, in chapter 10, verse 6 of Zechariah, he says, I will strengthen the house of Judah and save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back because I have compassion on them. He says that right here. Still hadn't happened. So logically, we have two options. Either he still plans to do it, or he's a liar. Those are the two options. I tend to go with, he still plans to do it. Or third option, which is just stupid, trying to eat your cake and have it too. He meant spiritually, he's going to bring back the people of Joseph, and they're going to be the church. Okay. Also, I have a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. Okay, but you with me? Like, this is part of why I'm a dispensationalist, and we'll be mentioning that more, because I believe God's still got something going on he's going to do with Israel, the whole nation of the 12 tribes of Israel. And it's really hard to avoid that when you read this text, when you read any of the prophets, when you read Revelation 22, where we have the 12 tribes there, the 12 stones being the 12 foundation stones of the tribes of Israel as the foundation of this city, the New Jerusalem. All of this Israel language. Maybe he's got a plan for them. I'll get off this high horse, and we'll keep going. But does that make sense to you? Like, how I come to that conclusion? Okay. Let's get back over here. He talks about how he's going to bring low the other nations. I want to get on to chapter 11. This is an interesting little allegory, and there's not many times you actually get to see an allegory, a true allegory in the text, and here's one of them. So, talk about this for a little bit. I'll read it first. I want you to be picturing what's happening. I'm trying to emphasize the points. It comes in two phases, verses 4 through 14, and then verses 15 through 17. So, chapter 11, verse 4. Thus says the Lord my God. So God is talking to Zechariah. Become shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter. Those who buy them slaughter them and go unpunished, and those who sell them say, blessed be the Lord, I have become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of this land, declares the Lord. Behold, I will cause each of them to fall into the hand of his neighbor, and each into the hand of his king, and they shall crush the land, and I will deliver none from their hand. So I became the shepherd of the flock, doomed to be slaughtered by the sheep traders. And I took two staffs, one I named Favor, and the other I named Union, and I tended to the sheep. In 1 month I destroyed the three shepherds. I became impatient with them, and they also detested me. So I said, I will not be your shepherd. What is to die, let it die. What is to be destroyed, let it be destroyed. And let those who are left devour the flesh of one another. And I took my staff Favor and I broke it, annulling the covenant that I had made with all the peoples. So it was annulled on that day, and the sheep traders who were watching me knew that it was the word of the Lord. Then I said to them, if it seems good to you, give me my wages, but if not, keep them. And they weighed out as my wages 30 pieces of silver. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the Lord the price at which I was priced by them. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter. Then I broke the second staff, Union, annulling the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Then the Lord said to me, take once more the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I am raising up in the land a shepherd who does not care for those being destroyed, or seek the young, or heal the maiden, the maimed, or nourish the healthy, but devours the flesh of the fat ones, tearing off even their hooves. Woe to my worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. Let his arm be wholly withered, his right eye utterly blinded. Tell me the basic story. What is this? First of all, give me the real version of this allegory. Who's Zechariah playing? What's he doing with the people? So let's go bit by bit. Verse 4. What does God tell him to do? Yeah. I do think ESV renders the feed verb there well. Become a shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter. So you're going to act as a shepherd over the people doomed to slaughter. Who are the people doomed to slaughter?
Well, they could either be talking about unbelievers in general or Gentiles.
Good. Or what's another possible option? Greece? Was it even another possible option? Who, if you're talking about God setting up somebody to shepherd his peoples, who are his peoples, probably?
Jews.
Jews. Israel. So either we're talking about, like, Gentile peoples, or we're talking about the Jews, or, don't know yet, though. But whoever they are, they're doomed to slaughter. I'm going to try and show you why I think it is Israel that he's talking about, as the peoples. But keep going. Those who buy and buy them, slaughter them, and go unpunished, and those who sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. So, if the people who he's shepherding are those doomed to slaughter, who are the ones who are buying them for slaughter and profiting off of them?
Those who have conquered
the nations.
Babylon, Assyria.
Babylon, Persia, Greece, Assyria, yes. Okay. They're saying, I've become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. As in, they're mistreating the people of Israel. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of this land, declares the Lord. Behold, I will cause each of them to fall into the hand of his neighbor, and each into the hand of his king, and they shall crush the land, and I will deliver none of them from their hand. The inhabitants of this land, who's that?
The Jews.
I'm thinking the Jews, probably. Or the people who are doomed to slaughter. What's he going to do for them?
Not going to save any of them.
Yeah. They're going to fall in the hands of his neighbor, each in the hands of his kings, crush the land, deliver none of them. So we're getting a message of judgment for Israel now, if they're the people doomed to slaughter. Keep moving. So, I became the shepherd of the flock. So this is Zechariah writing. So this is what I did. I went out, I started shepherding the flock. I started prophesying to Israel, telling them what God wants them to do for them. And I took two staffs, like, sort of as two examples. One of them he calls favor or grace. The other one he calls
union.
Verse 7? Union. So we got grace and we got union. If we're talking about Israel, what's the union probably representing? Union between who and who?
Judah
and Israel, north and south. Yeah. Or, other option,
Jews and Gentiles.
The 12 tribes.
The 12 tribes. One more that I'm thinking of.
God and his people.
God and his people, yeah. And I tended the sheep. So those are all the options, yes. So keep all those in mind. It's like, okay, so that's our semantic domain. Those are the options. We have to focus in which one is he talking about. Which union is this staff representing? I tended the sheep. In 1 month, I destroyed the three shepherds. Three leaders of various nations around them. I'm not exactly sure who that reference is. So we're going to keep on. But I became impatient with them, and they also detested me. So the people, what are they doing? Back to Zechariah.
They're resisting him.
They're resisting him. They're not on board with his leadership. So I said, I will not be your shepherd. What is to die, let it die. What is to be destroyed, let it be destroyed. And let those who are after devour the flesh of one another. So, Zechariah says, fine. I took my staff favor, I broke it, annulling the covenant that I had made with all the peoples. That's a, like, anytime you hear the word covenant, your ears perk up. All right, so he made a covenant with the peoples. That'd be another thing why I think this is the people of Israel. Keep going. So, I'll be clear on what Zechariah's done with the people so far. Shepherded them. They sort of rebel on him, so he breaks the staff of favor. He says, wash my hands with you, I'm done with your people. Verse 11. So it was annulled on that day. The sheep traders who were watching me knew that it was the word of the Lord. Then I said to them, if it seems too good to you, give me my wages, but if not, keep them. And they weighed out as my wages, 30 pieces of silver. Now, you as a New Testament reader, what does your mind go to when you hear the phrase 30 pieces of silver?
Judas. And the potter's field.
And the potter's field. What? So, yeah, let's keep... So, Zechariah says to the people, the sheep traders, some of the leaders among the sheep, give me my wages, if it seems good to you, if not, keep them. So pay me what you want, or
don't
pay me at all. And they say 30 pieces of silver, that's what you're worth. So they weighed out 30 pieces of silver. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the lordly price at which I was priced by them. So they priced me, Zechariah, the shepherd of Israel, 30 pieces of silver. And God says, throw it to the potter's field. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter. And then I broke the second staff, union, annulling the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Ah, get our definition. Which one is it? Which one is the union staff?
Judah and Israel.
Judah and Israel. All right, North and South Union. That whole thing, I very much believe, is an allegory. A few times an allegory is like an extended metaphor that's being played out in first century Israel to explain what's going to happen with the Messiah. Zechariah, representing the Christ, comes to his people Israel, says, let me shepherd you with favor and unity. They reject him. Yeah? And so he breaks his staff of favor for the people of Israel. He says, give me your price. What is the price? 30 pieces of silver. That is the lordly price at which I was priced by them. That's what Jesus' life was worth. It was priced at 30 pieces of silver. What does Judas do with the 30 pieces of silver? Throws it back into the temple at the feet of the people who gave it to them, and then goes and hangs himself in the potter's field. You go read, look at that.
They use the silver to buy the field.
They use the silver to buy the field.
To bury strangers.
And so he broke the second staff union. So this is the first half. This is Christ, this is the Gospels. This is all four Gospels are telling this story. Jesus coming to the people of Israel, the people of Israel rejecting them, and so the Gospel going out to the Gentiles. That is the Gospels. And this is why when you're reading the Gospels, you've got to be really careful about what you apply of what Jesus is saying to yourself, because he's talking to Israel. The first half of all four of the Gospels, Jesus is coming to the people of Israel, and he specifically says in a couple places, you Gentiles, I'm not here for you. I'm here for the people of Israel, the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
First to the Jew,
then to the Gentile. So there are lots of places in the Gospels where you can't apply what Jesus is saying to you. You have to read it in context. You have to know the story that is unfolding. How the Gospel and how redemption and salvation is coming to all people through the Messiah, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. And you have this play acting out, sort of, that God predestined beforehand. So that's the first half of this allegory. The second half, starting in verse 15. Then the Lord said to me, take once more the equipment of a foolish shepherd. What translations do you guys have there for foolish shepherd?
Foolish shepherd. Where is it?
Verse 15, end of 15.
Foolish shepherd. Yeah, foolish shepherd.
Really? Okay. You should leave it there. Foolish shepherd, for behold, I am raising up the land in the land, excuse me, a shepherd who does not care for those being destroyed, or seek the young, or heal the maimed, or nourish the healthy, but devours the flesh of the fat ones, tearing off even their hooves. So what is God saying is going to happen after this first shepherd comes? There's going to be another shepherd who comes along, and he doesn't have benevolent hopes for this people, Israel. And he's going to not help them. He's going to tear off their hooves. Woe to my worthless shepherd who detests the flock. May the sword strike his arm, his right eye. Let his arm be wholly withered, his right eye utterly blinded. Who is this guy?
A beast.
Thinking it's the beast. The Antichrist, as most people call him. Beast from Revelation chapter 13, the little horn in Daniel, this guy who is coming, who is going to deceive the nations. I think this is the guy. This is the Antichrist guy.
What about the, was it Satan's 1,000-year reign or whatever before Jesus comes and puts him into the lake of fire?
Because Satan doesn't have a thousand. He has a 1,000-year imprisonment, and then he gets released.
Well, when he gets released.
So, yeah, that's possible, too. So.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, so let's flip real quick over to that. Okay, we got that. That's Revelation 20. So Revelation 19 is the second coming, right? Jesus comes back, wages war, casts the beast and the false prophet into the lake of fire, casts Satan into the pit and locks it for 1,000 years. Verse 7, start there, chapter 20. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle, their numbers like the sand of the sea. They marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, but fire came down from heaven and consumed them. I love that. That's one of my favorite, like, anticlimaxes. He's getting this war ready, they're marching over the plains, they're about to assault the city, but fire came down and consumed them.
Over the sands of the seas.
And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire, sulfur, the beast and the false prophet, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they were tormented day and night forever and ever. So yeah, could be referring to that. Yeah, I'll just leave that there. Everybody kind of understand this allegory? This little play that Zechariah is acting out with the people of Israel? We'll go on to the second oracle. Finish out Zechariah. Chapters 12 through 14 is oracle number 2. Read along with me. Verse 1. The oracle of the word of the Lord concerning Israel. Thus declares the Lord who stretched out the heavens and founded the earth and formed the spirit of man within him. This is what he says. Behold, I am about to make Jerusalem a cup of staggering to all the surrounding peoples. The siege of Jerusalem will also be against Judah. On that day, I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will surely hurt themselves, and all the nations of the earth will gather against it. On that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with panic and its riders with madness. But for the sake of the house of Judah, I will keep my eyes open. When I strike every horse with peoples with blindness, and the clans of Judah shall say to themselves, the inhabitants of Jerusalem have strength through the Lord of hosts, their God. On that day I will make the clans of Judah like a blazing pot in the midst of the wood, like a flaming torch among sheaves, and they shall devour to the right and to the left all the surrounding peoples, while Jerusalem shall again be inhabited in its place in Jerusalem. Pause right there. So, what's the basic word of the Lord to Jerusalem, the people of Israel?
I'm going to make you a heavy burden to the people around you.
Everybody around you is going to stumble over you, and what's going to happen to them?
They're going to get burnt.
They're going to get burnt. You're going to be like a fire, and they're going to be like dry kindling. You're going to win real quick. Yeah. What are the possible things that he's talking about? What are the possible historical events that, or future historical events, possible future historical events? What do you think?
Second coming,
definitely on the list. Possible future historical events. What else? Read verse 2. It says, behold, I am about to make Jerusalem a cup of staggering to all the surrounding peoples. Or I will very soon make Jerusalem a staggering to all the surrounding peoples.
It could probably be interpreted as the first coming as well.
Could be the first coming. A little bit harder to swing that one with all the war imagery, but if we're going to spiritualize it. All right? So it could be second coming with the rider on the white horse. Could be the first coming with a spiritual interpretation. What else could it be?
It could be like stretched over time, like he's made them a burden now, and then later
at the end,
he will...
Interesting. That's a good thought.
Everyone right now is tripping over Israel.
That's possible. So It's like a, an extended period of time, and it's like starts right here, and then it's continuing, it's stretched out over until the end when the war comes. Good thought.
Could it be Armageddon?
Yeah, Armageddon. That's second coming.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if that's included.
Yeah. No, good call. Yeah. Could be talking about Armageddon. Another one that I'm thinking it might be, and I'm not decided on this one, so this one, I'm just bringing up the possibilities and letting you decide for yourself. The Hashemian Dynasty, the Maccabean Revolt. This seems to fit a little bit with that. The way that that revolt went down. Israel's just sitting there. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids are fighting over Israel. And then Matty Boy has his little revolt and all hell breaks loose and they become their own little entity there.
I don't know enough about that time period. History of that to be able to tell.
Yeah, it basically is. It's what did you say? Yeah, caught the crossfire, and Greece tries to tell them you can't sacrifice anymore. You can't worship God the way you want to. We're going to defile your altar. Matthias Maccabeus comes up and kills the guy who's trying to profane the altar. And he and his sons lead a revolt and sort of set up we're Israel again, and their dynasty sort of goes until about till about 20 years before Christ. So
it's like mine says he's about to make Jerusalem a cup that brings dizziness, so the Maccabeans or the Ptolemies and Seleucids go at it. Judah is besieged.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Maccabeans come up and make Jerusalem a heavy burden for all nations who try to carry it.
What verse are you talking about with the Jerusalem a heavy burden?
Well, it comes 12:2 and then 12:3, moreover, on that day, I will make Jerusalem a heavy burden for all of the nations who try to carry it. Will
hurt
be themselves. Seriously injured.
Uh-huh.
But the thing after that, it says the peoples of the earth will be assembled against it.
Yeah, there you go. So that would be a strong argument against the Hashemian dynasty interpretation. Unless the peoples of the earth there is being defined as Ptolemy, Seleucids, Romans.
It could just be people who are on
it. All right. Keep reading verse 7. And the Lord will give salvation to the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the heavens of Jerusalem may not surpass that of Judah. On that day the Lord will protect the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the feeblest among them on that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord going before them. And on that day I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. What would these verses sort of indicate? Which option is most likely?
Second coming
kind of stuff, yeah. Verse 10, we get some more messianic stuff. We're in chapter 12, verse 10. Does somebody want to read there? Verse 10 through 13, 1.
And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. On that day the weeping in Jerusalem will be great, like the weeping of Hadad Rimon in the plain of Megiddo. The land will mourn, each clan by itself, with their wives by themselves, the clan of the house of David and their wives, the clan of the house of Nathan and their wives, the clan of the house of Levi and their wives, the clan of Shimei, and their wives, and all the rest of the clans and their wives. On that day, a fountain will be opened to the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and impurity.
This is where it throws a kink in all my interpretive understanding, because we got some clear images of first coming, Got some clear images of the second coming and some stuff in between. So I haven't quite worked through how to make it all make sense. This is kind of why I throw the whole Hashemian dynasty into the picture. Maybe we're trekking from this point all the way through the second coming. Possible thought, but yeah.
And you could take the whole extended time view on it and say, because it seems to kind of suggest something more on the time of the Hashemian dynasty at first, but then the day, clearly says day,
right.
That's a clear second coming thing.
Yeah, on that day, that kind of phrase was like, okay, that seems like Day of the Lord stuff.
So maybe it's the extended.
Right.
So one of those. I mean, if he used it before, why not use it again?
Right.
Because no doubt that Israel is like, it just sounds messed up in my head, but it's become a heavy burden for anyone who's trying to like protect it or have any part of it.
Yeah.
But it hasn't come up like a burning torch.
But ain't nobody's been able to lift it up yet.
Yeah. And someone's going to break their back trying to do it.
Yeah. What else is going to happen on that day?
It's going to be murder.
People will be crying.
Yeah, we'll cut off the names of the idols. This is chapter 13, verse 2.
Oh, okay, sorry.
And you're reviewing, yeah. I tend to skip over just because I don't know. So, I think it's kind of like that thing, like, you got, like, a hazy picture of kind of what's going on. Parts of it are clear, but I don't see how they all fit together yet. So, I'm trying to show you the hazy picture that I see and see if you can clear it up for me.
Well, maybe all the weeping is the second coming, and they're realizing, oh, he was our Messiah. And so they're weeping because they didn't realize it. And then the fountain will be opened to the house of David. That's, like, the Jews' last chance to get in on the right side.
And that actually made me think of, might even be talking about Great White Throne, like the last day. On that day, the morning in Jerusalem will be as great as the morning for Hadad-Rimon in the plain of Megiddo, as in the battle that just happened, right? Har-Megiddo. In that place. And now we're all standing before the throne, and all these families are weeping because, like you said, they didn't recognize. They were on the wrong side. Interesting thoughts. Let's keep going. 13:2. On the day the Lord declares the Lord of hosts, I will cut off the names of the idols from the land so that they will be remembered no more, and I will also remove from the land the prophet, the spirit of uncleanness. If anyone, again, prophesies, his father and mother who bore him will say to him, you shall not live, for you speak lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and mother who bore him shall pierce him through when he prophesies. So if you prophesy on that day, you're obviously wrong, because prophecy isn't going on. And so parents are going to kill their kids for prophesying.
Is it because prophesying isn't going on, or because prophecy has been fulfilled?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, both.
Okay.
Like, it's been fulfilled, so it's not going on.
Okay.
On that day, every prophet will be ashamed of his vision when he prophesies. He will not put on a hairy cloak in order to deceive, but he will say, I am no prophet, I am a worker of the soil, for a man sold me in my youth. And if one asks him, what are these wounds on your back? He will say, the wounds I received in the house of my friends. I don't know. This sounds kind of like Millennial Kingdom stuff to me, where Christ will be ruling on earth, and so there will be no need for prophecy. And so if someone tries to prophesy, they will be
shown as false.
Exactly.
The hairy cloak thing is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because he's referencing, I would assume, Esau and Jacob, how he put on a hairy cloak to deceive.
I didn't even think of that. I was thinking hairy cloak, more of a reference to Elijah and John the Baptist coming
in.
Yeah, but thought. We're going to skip down to 14, because that's where start to understand a little bit more. This is what I affectionately title The Return of the King. A nice little LOTR allusion. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. It's going to be a joyous time. Half of the city shall go out into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. On that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley, so that one half of the mountain shall move northward and the other half southward. And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains, where the valley of the mountains shall reach Azal. You shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. What are we talking about here? This one's pretty clear.
The vision from earlier.
The vision from earlier with the horses coming between the mountains, a.k.a.
Second coming.
Christ showing up with his holy ones to destroy. And...
well, and that's also from Thessalonians.
Correct. Good.
The Lord comes out of the clouds with those who have already died in him.
Yes. It's Thessalonians. It's also Revelation. Chapter 6, during the seven seals. I opened the sixth seal, and I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake. You shall flee, as you did, fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah. And the sun became black as sackcloth, the moon, full moon became like blood, the stars fell from the earth, the fig trees, winters, the fruit and wind shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll being rolled up, every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth, and the great ones, and the generals, and the rich, and the powerful, and everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in the caves among the rocks of the mountains. And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach to Azal. You see in the similarities here? It's definitely second coming stuff. It's definitely tribulation, second coming stuff. So, Zechariah 14, verse 6, on that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost, and there shall be a unique day, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light. Does that ring a bell for you at all?
There will be no sun or no moon because God, and they will be the light.
Right. So on this unique day, on this day known to the Lord, there will be no night there. Revelation 21:22. No need for the sun or the moon. The Lord your God will be the light to them. It's in Zechariah. John wasn't saying anything new. Verse 8. On that day... so on this unique day that is known to the Lord, Revelation 21:22. Living waters shall flow out from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea, half of them to the western sea. It shall continue in summer as in winter, and the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day, the Lord will be one, and his name one. The whole land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem shall remain aloft on its site, from the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate, to the corner gate, and to the tower of Hananel, to the king's wine presses, and it shall be inhabited. For there shall never again be a decree of destruction. Jerusalem shall dwell in security. This is the new Jerusalem. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord shall strike all the peoples that wage war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. And on the day a great panic from the Lord shall fall on them, so that each will seize the hand of another, the hand of the one who will be raised against the hand of the other. Even Judah will fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be collected, gold, silver, garments, in great abundance. And a plague like this plague shall fall on the horses, the mules, the camels, the donkeys, and whatever beasts may come in those camps. Then everyone who survives of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths. And if any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. And if the family of Egypt does not go up to present themselves, then there shall be no rain. If the plagues with which the Lord afflicts the nations do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths, this shall be the punishment to Egypt and the punishment to all the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. On that day, there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, Holy to the Lord, and on the pots in the houses of the Lord shall be as the bowls before the altar. And every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holy to the Lord of hosts, so that all who sacrifice may come and take of them and boil the meat and sacrifice in them, and there shall be no longer a traitor in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day. I don't understand a whole lot of that. But I do know it's talking about what we're going to be doing for the rest of eternity, how the system's going to work. The Lord will be there. We're going to be celebrating the Feast of Booths. Unless this also, quick possible explanation. Verses 12 through 21 is back to Millennial Kingdom. And verses 6 through 9 is Eternal State. So it's like, 6 introduces this special, unique day to the Lord. And then verse 10, he switches back. Let me tell you what's going to happen at the Millennial Kingdom to all those people who aren't following the Lord. I think that fits a little bit better. Ezekiel seems to talk about a temple that will be placed in the Millennial Kingdom. And so that fits. Whereas in Revelation, we see there is no temple. There is no need for a temple because God is living with them, right? So that, I think, is what's happening there. Verses 6 through 9, eternal state. Verses 10 to the end, millennial kingdom. But there's a whole lot of stuff. Like, that's where it is. If you sit down and sort it out and say, you want to know what life in the millennial kingdom and the eternal state is going to be like? It's going to be like that. I know that.
Okay, so the one that the plagues are happening against, those
are the ones that continue to reject Christ? Yeah.
Okay. So I was like, wait a minute, that's just good. It's a good kingdom. Good for us, but not good for Israel.
Yeah,
or
good for Israel.
Well, us grafted in as well, right?
I think so. I'm not sure if we'll be in the Millennial Kingdom. I haven't quite figured out where I'll end on that.
Maybe we'll be outside, like, city.
I think that's for sure where we'll be in eternal state, I think. But I haven't quite figured out where I land on millennial kingdom. Does the church, do the Gentile believers of the church return with Christ at the second coming, or do they come down with the new Jerusalem once the heaven and earth are remade? I'm not sure. If you have any arguments for or against one, I'd love to hear them. Everyone take a big, deep sigh of relief.
Zacharias
died.
That's not a fourth?
No. We did take 4 lessons to do it, but there were only 3 handouts. Alright. Next week we'll cover Malachi, which is a fairly short book. I think he's 5 chapters long. 4 chapters. We'll do a good long review of all of our prophets, and we'll talk about Review Jeopardy, which is coming. And I say next week is Easter Sunday, so I figured we would not meet. Most people have
diarrhea.
So in 2 weeks we'll do Malachi, and then following week we'll do Jeopardy, and then that'll be about the time when we start meeting for Riggins.